This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I remember reading about an experiment a few years ago at DePaul University where researchers wanted to test whether just by touching another person, you could communicate an emotion. So they built this barrier in a laboratory that separated two strangers from each other. One person stuck out their arm through the barrier, and they waited to be touched. The other person was given a list of emotions that they were to think about and try to convey simply through a one-second touch. The receiver had to decide which emotion was being communicated. And what the researchers found is that 6 of the 12 emotions they studied could be expressed, could be passed on, just by touch. And when you learn how intricate touch is, as we did recently from the neurologist David Linden, none of that is a surprise. Linden took us through what he described as this weird, complex, and often counterintuitive system of touch, the receptors in our skin, the nerve fibers, how it's all blended with the other sensory input to make it work. Now, we'll get to that here in a moment, but we also wanted to explore on the program the more abstract part of touch, what we miss when we all can't reach out and touch those close to us because we're all pinned down by a spreading virus. So we're going to start today with Kristen Hodson. She's a social worker in Salt Lake City, the founder and executive director of The Healing Group.
I'm seeing people's relationship with touch be impacted on all levels. It's something where it's impacting all ages, stages of life, and it's really interesting to watch people's relationship with touch shift. And I don't even think before COVID people realized maybe they had a relationship with touch, and this has brought forth their relationship, meaning there are people that describe themselves like, I didn't realize that I was not a touchy person until I couldn't have it. And now I really am craving to be touchy and I can't. Or the mom that I was just talking to that is totally touched out, does not want another finger to touch her body. My 5-year-old that really just wants to see her best friend because she misses hugging and communicating how much I love you as a friend through a simple hug. And so all of these things are bubbling up as it relates specifically to touch.
So what you're saying are these kind of, I mean, they're the obvious touches, the physical touch, but there are these kind of even invisible things that are touch-like or are touches themselves that are woven into our everyday lives, you say, that we don't notice on a regular basis, I guess.
Yeah, I think, you know, I really think about the kids that transitioned to a new school. They jumped up from maybe elementary to middle school, and they're having to start a new environment with masks. And you don't have the touch of the friendly smile that can say, hey, I am glad you're here, or just new people reaching out without having to say a word. And I think these experiences are woven in. I had another interesting conversation about how touch can communicate even more than verbal or body language, that we communicate a broad range of emotions. And I had a friend who said, I've never been more thoughtful around touch and even verbalizing, hey, can I put my hand on your shoulder? That's not a given anymore. Do we, like, people, new people meeting and hesitating as they're, do we shake hands? Do we not? Like, these experiences that are woven in and baked into our everyday life are being challenged and shifted. And he brought up a good point of, I really assumed that maybe I could put my hand on an elbow or a person's knee to communicate empathy or sympathy. And I don't do that anymore. I'm uncertain in that.
What is it about a hug or a handshake or even a smile, you know, a friendly nod? What does that do you think, for us as human beings, as a social species? What role do those things play, do you think?
Connection. I think they all communicate connection, that when we are born, the moment we are born, we are wired to connect. And babies want to connect physically immediately. You know, we have skin hunger and we do kangaroo care and feeding of babies, and that's all through touch. And I think at times we may have just taken that as a given or that we don't really need it. And I think people are realizing this isn't just a want. Touching isn't just a, it's a nice to do. It's a, I need to do it. And I didn't realize that until it was challenged in new ways.
So what role does touch play in our mental health? And what are you seeing in your practice? People talk about the lack of this touch. What are you seeing in your practice that is giving you a sense that this is having some psychological or even maybe physical effect on them being deprived of it?
Yeah, I think it creates a different level of isolation. It can create depression. It can create anxiety because I think having someone seek you out through touch, just holding a hand, having someone reach over for comfort, these all connect us as human beings, which that really supports our mental health. I think people are isolated, but not being able to touch can lead to a loneliness, and that in and of itself is a big mental health issue. Loneliness can extend into all these other areas of our emotional and mental lives. So I think this lack of touch, even the inability of maybe I didn't want it, but now I can't even have it if I did, It really starts to take a toll in an everyday way that people aren't, that they weren't as aware of prior.
Tell me about your 5-year-old.
She's in kindergarten and she misses her friends so much. One day she said, can we just call up, her name is Greta, can we just call her up and play? And it wasn't just playing. She's like, I want to give her a hug. I want to touch hearts. There's something in that exchange when they hug goodbye and they have a friendship hug that says, I love you and I can feel that you love me, and we get to exchange that through touch.
So what happened? Did you guys set that up?
Our friends actually surprised us with a porch visit. They're equally as careful. She was an ER nurse and they surprised us. The two little girls were both wearing masks. And we let them have a big hug. And they were giggling and having a friendship hug. And the boost that it provided to both of them, the energy that came from one simple hug. And then the smiles, they couldn't see each other's mouths, but they could see each other's eyes. And I think they were able to communicate so much through that one hug.
For those who cannot touch right now, what do you recommend as an alternative, just for the time being?
I think finding other ways to connect, tending to your own body, applying lotion, sitting in a bath, wrapping up in a weighted blanket. I've had people actually reach out and say, I am doing this quarantine alone. I am not partnered. I don't have children. And they actually got a weighted vest so it could feel like a hug. It could feel like some weight of something on their body. And so finding just some temporary ways to bring some comfort.
Kristen, thanks.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Kristen Hodson, she's a licensed clinical social worker, founder and executive director of The Healing Group. Now, if it all sounds mysterious, the power of touch, it doesn't have to be. It all makes sense when you understand how the human body has sculpted this system, these touch circuits, over millions of years of evolution. The neuroscientist David Linden will explain it when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West.
When you support the news that you trust on KUER, you can easily manage your financial contribution with MyKUER. It's our online portal where you can provide your contact information, change the amount of your donation, or update your billing information, like when your credit card expires or maybe you've switched financial institutions. You can sign up for an online donor profile at KUER.org/myKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The COVID-19 pandemic has created this world where we don't touch each other, not nearly as much as we used to. And we wanted to know, how would a touchless world change us? After the pandemic ends, will people even want to touch each other again? David Linden told us he hopes not, because if we ditch the handshakes and the hugs and the high fives, we may find ourselves living in a colder, less trusting world. Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and a few years ago he wrote a book called Touch. Before he got to the science part, he mentioned how intrinsically emotional touch can be. It's even reflected in the way we speak, the common expressions we use.
It seems trivial to say, but the fact that we call our emotions our feelings is not an accident, that they're not our sightings or our hearings or our smellings. Or when we say that I was emotionally affected, we say I'm touched. Or when someone is emotionally clumsy, we call them tactless. And you might think, well, okay, but is this just not something human? Is this just a quirk that happened recently in English? And the answer is no. Actually, this is found broadly. I don't know if it's in every language, but I'm told it is in Chinese. It is certainly in Magyar and Finnish and most of the Romance languages. So I think it points to something fundamental about the organization of the brain and the organization of how we think about our senses, that touch is indeed intrinsically emotional.
Do you know, historically, did we used to touch each other more in other times? Have we always been both inviting of a stranger's touch or a doctor's touch or a food server's touch? Or has that evolved over time, as far as you can tell?
Well, what I do know is that in the present day, there are enormous cultural differences about interpersonal touch. And this isn't quite the present day, but there was an anthropologist, a psychologist named Sidney Gerard. In the 1960s, he liked to spy on pairs of people in cafes. I don't remember the precise numbers, but he found like in an hour, there'd be 200 touches in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And in Paris, there might be 100. And in New York, 3. And in London, 0.
Yeah.
So clearly, it's not something that is immune to cultural ideas. And sometimes in certain religions, in Orthodox Judaism and Islam, there are very particular rules about touching, particularly across the sexes. So it's not just as if, I think if you look back in time, you would find everyone, touchy-feely all the time, and now people less so. I don't think it would be quite that simple.
All right, let's talk about how important touch is. Because here's something that you say, which is kind of striking. Touch is not optional for human development. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that you can be born blind, for example, and have a fully rich and normal life, and your mind and your body will develop completely normally. And the same if you're born deaf. But there really aren't genetic problems that cause people to be born with no touch sense. But if infants are deprived of social touch, and this has occurred a number of times historically, the one that's been most studied was orphanages in Romania under the dictator Ceausescu, what happened is that they banned all birth control, but then they didn't have enough money. And so there was a lot of unwanted pregnancies and a lot of children in orphanages, but they didn't fund the orphanages. So, the poor people, the adults in the orphanages were tasked with taking care of these babies. All the best they could do was like change diapers and prop bottles and run around to just try to barely keep the kids alive, but there was no time for them to get the normal kind of snuggling and affectionate social touch that babies need. And what happened as a result was really shocking. So these kids developed these rocking, compulsive, self-soothing motions. They had these problems with attachment, seizures. But what was amazing is that the medical problems were not just in the neuropsychiatric realm. They actually spread. They had more immune problems, digestive problems. They were just much less healthy all around. And then, you might say, well, okay, but is this really because of the lack of touch? Probably they had a lot of other problems in those orphanages too. And that's a good point. But the reason that we really think it had to do with the touch is that in some cases, there were volunteers who would come in and touch the babies and give them appropriate social touch. And that seemed to be enough. An hour or two a day of appropriate social touching of the babies seemed to be enough to rescue the entire spectrum of symptoms.
What happened when that volunteer would come into an orphanage and touch a child? What's going on in that touch?
Well, in the end, the information from the touch has to be conveyed via biology.
Yeah.
Through the child. It's not through some mystic ether.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that isn't interpreted in a inbuilt social framework. In other words, newborns are trained to imprint on those they receive social touch from. Mm. But what we do know is that there are receptors in the skin, both of the newborn and of the adults, that seem to have their properties tuned to receive social touch. Now, once you're at that point, it becomes a bit of a mystery. I would love to be able to say, oh, and this is what then regulates them emotionally and socially and in the immune system and the digestive system through these particular steps. But really, that's where our knowledge gets pretty hazy.
What about the necessity of touch? So we understand that in human development. What about its necessity in our interpersonal interactions? What about touch in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods? Is that also, do you think, in some ways, not optional? I guess I'm wondering, do you think touch is necessary to make a society work, function?
Well, I think it helps. Let me put it this way. I don't know if I would go so far to say that it's absolutely necessary the same way it is in the first 2 years of life.
Yeah.
But, in the workplace, in the family, in the community, touch is social glue.
Yeah.
It's the way that you say, I'm not a threat. I'm on your side. We can trust each other. And that's what you want to do if you want to build a team, either a literal one for sports or a metaphorical one for work or some social cause. But I think we have to all be careful. It's not just that everyone should be pawing each other in the workplace, obviously.
How does it work in an evolutionary context? Because that's one of the things that you mention in the book is that our sense of touch, our touch circuits, for example, in the brain, which we'll get to, you describe them as having been sculpted to solve particular evolutionary problems.
Well, right. The circuits in our brain, and I think also the receptors in the end of our skin. So touch isn't just a unitary sense. In your skin, there are nerve endings, and each nerve ending is a highly specialized micro machine. One is for fine form, one is for pressure, one is for vibration, one is for sexual sensation, one is for this social touch and hair bending, right? There are, probably on the order of 15 of these different nerve endings, some for heat and cold and spicy chemicals and cool mint and it goes on and on. But I mean, I think if you look at our primate relatives in terms of social touch, you see an awful lot of variation. So you can see primates that live in large groups, like gelada baboons, that, you know, groom each other all day long. And it's way more than they need to do just to pick a few insects off and get a few twigs out of the fur. It's clear that this is the way that they make their society work, and they develop allyship and, you know, who's got who's back and, you know, who's where in the social order. But, you know, if you go to look
Professor, I want to just jump in on that point, because I wanted you to say something about that group of baboons, because there was one sort of form of behavior related to touch that I found particularly interesting and maybe instructive. And the way two dominant males went after they would fight and one would lose, one would offer touch, would offer grooming. It seemed like a way of de-escalating, getting a balance back in the group.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if a beta deposed an alpha and now you're the new king, what do you want? Well, you don't want the deposed king to go, like, you know, plot to dethrone you again. You know, so part of what you want to do is you want to make nice, and then you go groom him and he grooms you, and it's like, okay, we're okay. We don't have to fight again and endanger each other with our teeth. We can, you know, have these affiliative behaviors that will make the peace. And this is seen not just in gelada baboons, but in a number of other primate species, famously in bonobos, right, have been gotten a lot of attention.
You write about the effect of touch on rats, for example, in a laboratory when mothers lick and groom their newborn pups, and the response that it elicits, like a hormonal response. And this was interesting. You said when these mothers wouldn't lick or didn't lick or groom their babies, that the babies grew up with, in some cases, impaired learning, or were more, this was interesting, more fearful in some cases, more and less likely to explore new environments or try different types of food.
Yeah, that's right. And so, they were less likely to explore new environments and try different types of food. And you might think, well, gosh, then why wouldn't every rat mom just lick the hell out of her pups all the time?
Right.
It just would make sense. But, you know, the problem is it actually takes a long time to do it. You know, a pup litter, it might be 12 pups. You got to go do it methodically. And essentially, it's work-life balance, you know? It's like if you are a fortunate rat and you've got lots of food around you and you don't have to spend too much time foraging, then you can afford to spend lots of time licking and grooming your pups. If, on the other hand, you have to run out for food all the time and food is scarce and, you know, you're like a poor rat, then you just don't have time to lick and groom your pups. Mm.
An important point that you mention in your writing is that there's no pure touch sensation, because by the time, at least if I understand this right, by the time we perceive it, it's been blended with this other sensory input. So our sense of touch or our perception of touch depends on context, I guess.
Right. It depends on context and it depends on expectation. The example I like to use is, you know, imagine a caress on your inner arm from your sweetheart in a very loving, connected time. Mm. And then imagine that very same caress arriving in the middle of an argument.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, physically, it's exactly the same thing. It's the same number of grams of force, the same velocity, the same number of hairs displaced. You know, everything you would want to measure about it physically would be the same. The pattern of electrical signals going from your skin to your brain would be the same. But it's not as if initially perceive it the same way, but then after a moment you think about it differently because of the context. It actually feels different from the very first moment of the perception. And that is because touch perception is actually broken into at least two different bits in the brain. There's one stream of information that is all about the facts, Just the facts, ma'am, as they said on Dragnet, right?
Right.
All, you know, where on my body am I being touched? How strong is it? Is it moving? What's the nature of the touch? Is it painful? You know, all the facts. And then there is a separate, and that part of the brain is called the primary somatosensory cortex. And then there is a another area called the insula. And the insula is evaluating the emotional context. How do I feel? How does this touch make me feel? Is it good or bad? Is it positive or negative? Do I like it or not like it? And that part of the brain receives input from many other parts of the brain that have your past experiences, your expectations, your memories, and of course your emotional state. And so the action on the insula is why that touch in the middle of the argument feels so different from the touch in the loving connected time.
What does the National Basketball Association tell us about social touch? and the skin is a social organ, because you write about this.
Yeah. So this is a great study, and what they did is that they got the videotapes for a whole season's worth of NBA games, and then they scored them for all the celebratory touch, you know, all the pats on the rear end and the, you know, chest bumps and all the different things people like to do to celebrate a basket. And they asked the question, was, does the degree of celebratory touch predict how the team played? And the answer is yes. Not only did teams that have more celebratory touch win more, but they actually played in a more cooperative style. Like the star player would be more willing to pass off to someone else who had a better shot rather than hog the ball. Mm. So this really reinforces the notion that touch is social glue, and it's what binds teams and families and workplaces together.
Why is it that we cannot, most of us anyway, tickle ourselves?
So the reason that most of us can't tickle ourselves, and there's a few people who can.
Yes.
You know, when I give lectures in big auditorium, I'll always say, who here can tickle themselves?
Yeah.
Inevitably, a handful of hands go up.
Yeah.
And the reason is that because we are, it makes sense for us to pay less attention to sensations that result from our own movement and concentrate on things that originate in the external world, because the external world is where the threats are, it's where the foods are, it's where the mates are, right? So, for example, if you're walking down the street, you don't really notice the sensation of your clothes moving against your body as you walk. And the reason is because the parts of your brain that command your muscles to do the walking movements are sending information to a part of the brain called the cerebellum, that little baseball-sized guy that hangs off the back. And the cerebellum is turning those into inhibitory signals that go to the touch sensation parts of the brain and is damping down the sensation. So if you were standing at the street corner and suddenly you felt and you were standing still, and suddenly you felt the kinds of sensations on your body that you normally were produced by walking, well, you would jump and you would look around like, who's pawing me or what's going on right now? And so it's the same thing with tickling, right? When you go to tickle yourself, the commands from your motor cortex, which are sending signals to the motions in your muscles in your arms and fingers to make the tickling motion, those commands are going to your cerebellum. They're turned inhibitory, and then they go back to your touch centers, making it very hard to do that. So if you have cerebellar damage, then you can tickle yourself.
There was another part of the book I did want to ask you about, because this is the part of touch that as someone who's deeply rational as you are, I wondered what was the experience of writing it. And this is the more illusions and hallucinations and even the kind of transcendent touch experiences, because you're skeptical about a lot of this, but you do write about it. What do you make of the kind of sensory illusions? Because that is it's another facet. And say something about it, because this is really interesting.
For all the senses, there are things you can do that exploit the quirks of how things are wired up. I think many of us have seen visual illusions. But a good tactile illusion that I love is called the parchment hands illusion. Hmm. So if you take your hands and you rub them together, part of the way you evaluate their dryness is not just from touch, it's also from the sound they make.
Right.
So if when you're doing that, you put a pair of over-the-ear headphones that block out external sound, and then take a microphone and put it to your hands, well, you know, then you can, you're still getting that same sensation. But if you take the audio signal and then filter it to emphasize the high frequencies, then you will perceive your hands as being drier than they are. You can do a very similar thing with Doritos if you're crunching them in your mouth. Part of the way that we assess crunchiness is to do with the sound. And so if you do a similar headphone, microphone, filter the sound thing, again, if you emphasize the high frequencies, we think things are crunchier. So there are all kinds of tactile illusions, you know, some of which involve sensory integration and some of which are purely tactile.
I want to ask you about something that I guess falls into the transcendent or something that's really difficult to explain, I suppose. And it's these tactile sensations that people sometimes talk about, like your grandpa who says he can tell the weather's going to change because it's his bad, you know, he's got a bad knee and it always hurts, or that kind of creepy sensation that some say they feel on their necks before bad news is going to come. Now, you're skeptical about a lot of this, but you yourself, I have to say in the book, you do confess to feeling a prickly sensation from time to time when there's bad news. What's going on there?
Well, you know, I think mostly what's happening is selective recollection.
Hmm.
In other words, the times I felt a prickly sensation, nothing happened. I didn't attend to it. So, and then you remember the time when it seemed predictive, and isn't that cool? You know, I think the thing to realize is that, you know, like, for example, a lot of people say, I can feel someone's gaze on me, right? And actually, if you do this in really controlled conditions, nobody can feel a gaze on them, right?
Yeah.
Usually it's because someone's in the periphery of the visual field, or you're in a room and someone opened the door. You can kind of have the feeling of the wind or the pressure change when they open the door, or there's some other cue that allows you to say it. There really isn't a supernatural touch sensation that we can validate in the laboratory.
Hmm.
You know, that said, we are biologically hardwired for things to feel wonderful and transcendent. You know, when you have a bond with your child and they cuddle with you, or when you have, you know, a good sexual experience with someone you're in love with, you know, these things are transcendent, and they do take us out of ourselves in ways that we don't find in everyday experience, but that doesn't require a non-natural explanation. That all is accountable for within biology.
Let me bring us back to the moment we're in right now. A world divided, and we're physically separated, not just by COVID, but of course by digital technology, separated increasingly by, you know, our political disagreements. What does all of this mean, do you think, going forward in the post-COVID era, that we may not touch each other, we may not shake hands in the same way or give hugs or high fives? What do you think the effect of that is going to be?
Well, you know, I think it's going to look a lot like those places in the world that already had social ideas, barring a lot of that touch, even before COVID. I think it will make for a emotionally stunted, less cohesive, less trusting society. And I'm worried.
David Linden, thank you very much.
No problem.
David Linden, he's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. His book is Touch, the Science of the Hand, Heart, and Mind. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is your local NPR station, a connection to Utah and the world. Serving listeners is our top priority, and we welcome your feedback about our news and programming. If you have a few minutes, please consider filling out our online feedback form. You can tell us about issues you'd like us to report on in your community. You can also ask us a question about a story you heard on the air and more. To share your feedback, just go to KUER.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about touch. And we turned this week to the writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams, who's been holed up in her home in Castle Valley for most of the last 9 months, quarantining like the rest of us. In arranging the interview, she told one of our producers she was worried because there were times when she wondered if she actually had forgotten to speak. And I asked if she meant it.
I absolutely meant it. And being home, Doug, for 9 months, you know, I think, what am I giving birth to? And, you know, I remember years ago, I think in the year 2000, in a book of essays called Red, the last two pages are, one day I fear the desert will take the words out of me. And I don't fear that anymore because I feel it's happening. And even though Brooke and I, we have really not left, I made a commitment I would not be on a plane for a year. It may be more than that. I don't want to go back to the life I was living. I love being home. It suits my capacity as an introvert to be present. And what I realize is I don't feel isolated because you and I are having this conversation. I'm looking at a map of the world and, you know, from our chairs, we can have conversations all over the world. And for that, I'm deeply, deeply grateful. You know, so I think we're making accommodations. Do I miss contact with my own species? I do. Do I miss being able to hug someone when they come? I do. But I think something else is coming forth, whether it's placing our palms together in a bow, whether it's making a gesture of a circle around our hands. And I think the most important thing that I'm learning about touch, Doug, is I think our definition has been too narrow.
I happen to know you as a hugger.
It's hard not to hug people, right?
Well, that's the thing I wanted to ask. I mean, just for now, for many of the people that you would have reached out to, you know, you just can't or you shouldn't. So have you had to resist that reflex, and have you been able to tell if just not having the physical touch has had some effect on you?
I think we can't even know. I think we can't even know what is happening to us. You know, just as you asked that question, I can feel myself tearing up. The only, you know, aside from Brooke, obviously, the only person I have hugged was my brother Hank. And he had COVID in March, and we almost lost him. And he came down to the desert in April, and we just wanted to get him here so he could heal. And he stayed for 2 months. And when he got out of his car, I know there was this part of me that said, don't hug, it's dangerous. He could still, you know, be infected. I'm being honest, but it didn't matter. He's my one brother, and we just held each other close, you know. And when he came down for Thanksgiving, we hugged, and that I can't give up. But with my father, with Jan, you know, the stakes are so high. I don't want to expose them, and so touch becomes something else. We touch each other in other ways. Our conversations, the time that we share together. So I think we're redefining what touch means. But yes, I do think it's hard. And I don't think we'll even know the effect until we emerge from this. And will that be hard, you know, to touch one another again? What kind of masks or shields or armor have we created in the process?
The word, I guess the term that came to your mind during all of this was unraveling. You say you are unraveling. Say what you mean.
Oh, I think I'm completely unraveling. You know, I just wrote a piece for Emergence Magazine, and honestly, I thought I have nothing to say. I don't know how to speak. I don't know how to write anymore. I'm just being, which is such a gift. You know, being in the moment, watching the sunrise, watching the arc of the sun, watching the sunset, watching the moonrise over Adobe Mesa and setting behind Porcupine Rim. I mean, watching clouds, watching storms, praying for storms. You know, this is our life, watching deer, pinyon pine, watching pinyon jays bank a certain direction, the light shines on their wings and suddenly they're turquoise. You know, that is our life. And we feel so lucky and privileged to be part of that. The other side is the grief. 270,000 fellow citizens dead. That's more than on September 11th, and we made a religion out of that. You know, where is our grief going? This valley was choked in smoke much of the summer, 113 degrees. We are in a drought. I have never been in Castle Valley for 9 months without leaving in years, Doug. And I am now seeing it, feeling it. We've had, you know, in the summer, 2 inches of water in Castle Valley. I put 2 inches of water in a cup. That is a sip in very big country. Now we have up to 4.5 because of the snows. How are we not unraveling? 5 million acres burned, gone. If we're alive to the world, I have to believe we are unraveling. But maybe that's not a bad thing. Now, maybe this is both a reckoning and an awakening. And one of the things that was so interesting to me, thinking about what does it mean to unravel? You know, I think of a rattlesnake tightly coiled. When it unravels, it's finally relaxed. The danger is no longer there. And that at the root of unravel is to reveal what is being revealed to us. And I think your question about touch is part of that unraveling and revealing that, you know, I was talking about how when I don't know what something means, I literally go to the dictionary. And what was so interesting to me was all the different definitions of touch, to come into or be in contact with. It doesn't say human. You know, maybe we are just so anthropocentric, we don't think about what does it mean to touch sage, to be touched by the fingers of sage walking in the desert, to touch another species, a cat, a dog, to be touched by them, to be touched by heat, by snow, by weather, by one another's voice. I'm touched this morning just to hear you. And then it goes on to bring one's hand or body in contact with. So it's a deeper sense of touch. To have an effect on someone, to produce feeling of affection, gratitude, or sympathy with, to reach a specific level of awareness, aliveness, the measure or method of dealing with a specific situation. In that sense, the pandemic has touched all of us. So how do we go deeper with our feeling of what does it mean to touch and be touched?
You write this story about an encounter with a blue heron I wanted to ask you about. Explain what you saw and explain what interested you about that, because the blue heron, you write, wasn't unraveling.
Oh, it was so beautiful. You know, Brooke and I, it was last Sunday, and we went out past the Dewey Bridge toward the Dolores River. And we literally went to the end of the road where the river is. And we just started walking, and we found ourselves up on top of this bluff. We passed a pioneer grave flushed with flowers that had not lost their color. And when we looked out at the bend in the Dolores, there was this beautiful, striking silhouette of a great blue heron. And we just watched it. We watched its focus. We watched its grace. We watched it fishing in the shallows. And I thought the calm, the presence, the attention of this heron, it just allowed us to breathe in a deeper way. And I thought, this heron is not unraveling. This heron is living as its species was intended to live. And we watched it spear a fish. We watched it throw back its head and hurl the fish above, opening its mouth, and the trout went into its mouth, and we watched this bulge work its way down into the belly of this grand bird. It was a meditation. That heron is there whether we're watching it or not. That heron is there fishing with no desire to be anything else than what it is meant to be. And I thought, is it aware that the Dolores is carrying toxins from Colorado mines and uranium tailings? Is it aware that the water temperature is higher than normal because of climate? Is it aware that as it heads into the Colorado River, we are in a mega drought? I mean, I just wondered about all of those things.
Do you think that's the lesson? You know, to keep from unraveling is to pay attention to the world around us, to be mindful, to be focused on the task, like the heron was, I guess.
I do. And I think that's one of the gifts, is that we are home. And as frustrating as that might be, as difficult as it might be to work from home, as in close contact as we now are, you know, Brooke and I have had to say, okay, this is your part of the house, this is my part of the house, and our house is small. You know, and when we were out in the summer, it was so hot, we had to rearrange our time and days. We ended up night walking. You know, so I think we're making these adjustments, but the gift is we are together. We are healthy. We are focused. And to be creative in this space of presence, I think, is a deep gift. I think all of us on some level, I will speak for myself, we're half mad half the time, moving too quickly, doing too much. I don't want to go back to that life anymore. And I think Great Blue Heron models that behavior for us. I think we don't even know what we're capable of when we have this kind of time and curiosity as we take care of one another in the midst of a burning virus that is roaring through all of our communities.
You write in your piece that we are meant to engage. We're not meant to isolate in some ways. And that the thing that causes us to retreat, you say in that piece, is the same impulse that will allow us to reach out and, as you put it, dare to trust what is to come. What do you mean?
I mean, in a way, what choice do we have?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what these 2 months are going to be. I mean, we couldn't have imagined in February where we are now. So why not save the energy? I have come to believe for many years, I think through grief, if we are present, we will know what to do. And I want to stay present. You know, I want to be able to keep saying yes until I can't. That's also been a lesson during this pandemic, because I think my instinct is to retreat, especially when I'm here in the desert. But I've made a decision that I would say yes to whatever I was asked to do, because this is a time to be of use in whatever gifts we might have. And I've been so touched by people's offerings, you know, whether it's a neighbor bringing over jam, whether it's someone sending honey, whether it's, you know, the other day I opened a letter and these paper monarch butterflies flew out of this letter. And I had just been reading about the monarch massacre in Fargo, North Dakota, because a town decided to spray part of a mosquito abatement program right during the monarch migration. I mean, it's beauty and terror at once. And what is the role of the moral imagination? So I think our impulse to retreat is also our impulse to respond. And we are in this moment of paradox, of great tenderness and great terror, of not being able to breathe. We are holding our breath and we are exhaling at the same time. I think it's a spiritual moment. And again, our undoing has the capacity to be our becoming. I also realize the privileged place we are in. I mean, constant contact with friends in Indian country and, you know, in Montana. I mean, look at Utah, the interior West. Again, COVID is burning through our communities. And are we paying attention?
Terry, thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
The writer, Terry Tempest Williams. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.